This is Dr. Nick Sotelo bringing you episode of the Upgraded Life Podcast. In this show, I'm going to be featuring John Williams. John runs a nonprofit organization called Life That Counts. So if you want to hear from a man that is answering his calling to make a positive impact on the lives of young people, then this is the episode for you. People that turn their life focus to the younger generations do so more times than not because they have a powerful story that comes out of their own time as a child. And John Williams is no exception to that. So buckle in, get ready for a great interview, get ready for a great glimpse into a great man doing great things for the lives of young people. Hello, thanks for tuning in to the Upgraded Life Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Nick Sotelo. The Upgraded Life is my personal project where I help people realize and reach their potential. I've been a professional helper for 20 years. Here's what I'm convinced of. The life that you have right now and the life that you want tomorrow is a product of your personal mindset, mission, and movement. Each episode of the Upgraded Life Podcast is going to give you something that you can do as soon as the episode is over to upgrade your personal mindset. Your mindset informs your mission. Your mission tells you how to move every single day. And together, that is the Upgraded Life. All right, welcome to another episode of the Upgraded Life Podcast. Today, I have John Williams with me. And John Williams has a project called Life That Counts. And he and I have a ton of overlap in terms of the work that I've been doing for 20 years and the work that he's really been taking up for the last decade. So I'm super excited to hear more from him, hear about Life That Counts. And as always, the Upgraded Life is about your mindset and what can we do to improve your mindset. And I'm telling you, the work that John does on an everyday basis with the people that matter the most, which is our younger generation, he's going to be able to bring some powerful insight to us in terms of how we can invest in the younger generations and what can we do to help boost the mindset. So John, I'm going to throw it over to you. Tell us who you are, what you've been up to, and what in the world made you start something called Life That Counts.
Oh man, that's a lot. First off, I have to give props to my team. We've been blessed with federal grants and such, as you know, Nick, and even you've worked with some of these things in the past, so that there's where some of that overlap begins for us. But it's really our team these days who get to go into the field and work with students. You know, we got Gabby and Abraham and AJ and Anna, a lot of A's here, Colton and Laura and Kelly, you know, that we get to send these guys go out into the field and work with students. And it's just, man, it's just a privilege to work with these guys and to call these folks teammates and to put them out in the field and to be able to go out and serve kids the way that we do. The mission of Life That Counts is to help people make better decisions for more healthy outcomes. And I think at the end of the day, we would all be better served. Our future selves, self-efficacy, our future selves would all be better served if we showed up with better decision-making processes. You know, we're really the outcome of our decisions. You know, we're really our next greatest victory or our next greatest success is really going to be the outcome of our last greatest idea, you know? And so that's, I just want to give props to our team because they're amazing and we could not do the work that we do with our team. So I appreciate them, just the labor that they pour into this thing. And so it's really, My background in this work really begins just out of high school. I started volunteering. I was a volunteer youth minister at my church and then ended up full-time student ministry for about 15 years, different denominations. We served around the country. And my driving force there was really the same mission as it is today, to help students make better decisions for more healthy outcomes, right? I mean, it's, man, a good life, a life worth living is a life that is, you know, it's thought out, it's considered, it's what are my next steps? Why are my next steps? I don't want to just have the next emotional thing drive me along, right? I want to consider, I want to master plan my future. You know, I want to think about where it is that I'm going. Where did I come from? You know, what made me who I am today? Right. And so all things considered, okay, I know myself, I know my triggers. I know what makes me happy. I know what makes me sad. I know for me, I'm beginning to know for me what success looks like. I know my dreams. I know my aspirations. You know, I know those things that, man, wow, I want to do this, you know, whatever this is for you. Right. And so if we can begin to point ourselves in terms of those things and just begin to take the personal ownership to march one step after the other. It was Marianne Williamson, and I never do quote it exactly right, but she says, you know, our greatest fear isn't lives of inadequacy. She says our greatest fear is actually attaining that dream and that vision that we see for ourselves. And if we could do that, then what would that look like? You know, and so we weren't created to live small lives, but we're created to live big lives. We're created to add value. We're created to serve. We're created. She says, Williamson says, we're all created to shine. You know, and when we shine, we unleash that power, that same power to shine that we ourselves possess. We unleash that. We liberate those around us to shine as well. So I love that by Williamson. And so there's about 15 years of student ministry. And then it was time to do something outside of the four walls of a religious community, because I believe what we have to offer, it's more human, if you will. It's to me, it almost transcends between religious lines or denominational lines or anything like that. And I'm a person of faith, and I do believe that our Creator has created us all with purpose, and you know, there's something for us to do. And I just didn't want a particular label, you know, to get in the way of a person receiving what could be for them and in powerful and impacting truth to help liberate their lives, right? Sometimes the labels just get in the way, mm-hmm. You know? So we came together, we created this thing. And so Life That Counts is just celebrated 4 years of 501c3 status. The idea, we registered the business name back in 2012. It was actually the end of a federal grant. I just figured out using OJJDP resources, and you're familiar with OJ. I just figured out that we could do really amazing work in the school community through providing student programming. There's so much influence and power in peer relationship and peer influence. Peer influence is powerful.
So, John, for folks that are listening, break down that acronym, right? You and I both know what that is, but let people know what OJ is and what they're about.
Okay, yeah. So OJJGP is one of the offices that falls under the Administration for Children's and Families. The Administration for Children's and Families, it's a federally appointed, it's a wing of the federal government, which provides health and human services, which HHS, that's kind of another, but they provide health and human services for Americans. So it's something that, so Congress literally meets to vote to resource ACF, and under ACF, Administration for Children's and Families, at the last time I looked it up, they had 68 or 69 offices under ACF. One of those offices, OJJDP, that's the Office for Justice, Juvenile Delinquency Prevention. And of course, there is FISBE, which is Family, Youth, and Services Bureau. And so we're currently under federal funding streams through FISBE with SRAE, which is the sexual risk avoidance education, because, you know, as we know, if we can help young people value themselves and not just give themselves away freely, you know, but if you, if for example, we had a little bit of car trouble on a trip that we just got, and the guy hooked us up with this BMW, brand new BMW at the rental place, you know, and my wife and I are driving this thing. We're like, oh, brand new BMW, you know? And, so we've kind of taken care of it, you know, made sure it got into the garage last night, and you know what I mean? And you just do those things. And I mean, we're taking care of a rental car. It's a rental, it's a loaner. Why would you ever take care of a rental car? Nobody does that, right? It's a brand new car. So if we can teach people to value themselves,
yes.
If we can teach people to value their bodies, then, oh my gosh, dude, that's huge. I mean, you think about students who have been, who have been victims of abuse, or who have been victims of some sort of neglect, or who have been sex trafficked, or who have been taken advantage of in some way that was completely non-desirable to them, who had been introduced to very mature things at very young ages and had their childhood stripped away from them.
Sure.
And if we can help, oh man, if we can help these guys come into a place where they value themselves, regardless of their past, regardless of what's been done to them, regardless of even what they may have done to themselves of their own volition at the time, mm-hmm. right? Man, if we can help free these guys and help say, you know what, you are valuable, man. You have meaning. You have purpose. There's something to you that's amazing, and I want you to protect that.
Yes.
If we can do that, then we can help kids just turn the tide all together. Because sure. we're gonna take care of what we value.
Absolutely.
You know. So a part of my background and part of my story is I grew up in a very abusive situation, very abusive home. I've never met my biological father. If he walked into the room, I would not know who he is. And that was tough for me because, you know, growing up and like the one of the people in your life who's supposed to be there for you, just ducking out for no reason. Like it's like, dude, you had one job. Your name's supposed to be on the birth certificate, you know, right? You had one job. You're supposed to show up to birthdays. You had one job. You're supposed to get up every day and go to work and help my mom provide a living for us, you know? And, you know, by the grace of God, I have an amazing mother. My mom, oh my God, dude, my mom is hell on wheels. She's a great lady. Gosh, she's crazy, but I guess we made her that way, me and my two younger brothers. But, you know, props to my mom. My mom was the person who, you know, she taught me how to use a weed eater and she taught me how to sweep the floor, you know, and, my mom was, introduced me to, you know, faith at an early age. And even part of that was, you know, my mom had keys to the church. And so when my uncle would go on an alcoholic kind of a rage, you know, my mom would get me and my kid brother, we would leave and she would take us, we'd go drive through McDonald's or Captain D's or something. And she would get us something to eat. And, we'd go to the church and eat in like the fellowship hall in the kitchen. And then we vacuum the carpet or clean up something or, you know, random arts and crafts with mom day or something. And my mom was that for us. And I applaud that, man. I truly do. Cause you know, the mental, you know, the fortitude that my mom wielded as a single woman with two kids in the home that we grew up in was, it really, you know, I know the word that incredible means that which lacks credibility, or unbelievable, which means, you know, that's not worth believing. But the fortitude that my mom exhibited, the resilience that my mom exhibited was incredible. The mindset that my mom exhibited to move day after day, dude. I mean, wow.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. You know?
Yeah.
Thanks for sharing that. You know, I have come across lots of people with lots of different projects that they're doing. But there's a passion in how you talk about this and what brings you to every day with purpose. And here's what I'm convinced of. You know, you just talked about your mom, right? And that's huge. And I also know, or I have a bet or a guess or a hunch, that somewhere along the line, somebody saw something in you and said, son, you need to do something with yourself. Somebody, you know, invested in you. You know, the scripture talks about being plucked from the mire, so to speak, right? And so was that part of your experience? Because you've been doing this straight out of high school. So something had to have happened. Somebody had to pluck you out of the mire. And if that's the case, if I'm right, tell me a little bit about that.
You know, it's really kind of interesting, Nick. And I'll share something kind of deeply personal for me and for folks who are not religious, or not really spiritual, they may think I'm off my meds or something, but mm-hmm. you know, So all throughout my life, people have been kind with their encouragements toward me. And all throughout my life, people have made comments that they would say things that I wanted to believe, you know, but I didn't know how to believe, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. And it does.
They would offer encouragements and things like that. And it's like, oh man, I really wished what you were saying were true to me, but I can't believe it, you know, or I don't know how to believe it, or I don't know. And when I was, when I was 14 years old, I think I was 14 or 15, and I was with my church group at this youth conference in Charlotte, North Carolina. We were at the Charlotte Convention Center, I think. And it was one of those times where I grew up in a somewhat Pentecostal environment. And all of that never really stuck, to be honest. Some of it kind of wigs me out. I mean, I get it. It still kind of wigs me out a little bit. So my Pentecostal friends, I'm sorry. It's just how I feel, you know, whatever. But I'm down at the altar praying, right, with a couple thousand of my new best friends. And I remember just sobbing. And I was caught up in a really kind of a deep emotional headspace of, I wished I knew who my biological father was. I really do wish I knew who my biological father was. And in that moment, this lady who's a friend, and she's also like this international missionary. She's, you know, 100 countries around the world kind of a person. And she was like a missionary for the denomination. And she walks up behind me and she puts her hand on my shoulder and she says, John, I just want you to know that God's your father and he's always been there for you. And in that moment, dude, I just, you know, the floodgates of my eyeballs just opened up. And it was just a moment where I felt, it's a moment where I felt truly loved. And it's a moment where I felt just, you know what, there's nothing that I could do, good or bad, to jeopardize the deep sense of external love that I feel right now, you know? And for me, that was one of those pivotal turning points in my life. And that's not something that I've shared a lot of through the years. Matter of fact, I don't really remember the last time I shared that, but.
So let me be honest. Let me be honest here for my listeners. Okay. So yeah. I can't help but not be a counselor. Right. And so I've been trained and I have the experience of listening deeply into people's stories. And so this is kind of I didn't intend for this to be part of what I do in my podcast, but you're like the third person in a row that said, man, I've never really thought about that until you asked me that question. So full disclosure, I'm sorry. And that's just the way I roll. I can't shut that part of me down, especially when somebody like you is just willing to be upfront, vulnerable and transparent. So,
oh man, it's all good. It really is all good because, you know, there were people along the way and my mind also goes to some of the hurt along the way, you know, some of the people that you really wished you thought you could trust. And, you know, they had done a really good job of carving out a place of trust in your life. You know, they'd really done a great job of availing themselves to you. And then, you know, it's almost like on a dime, man, they would make a left or make a right and leave you behind, you know, and not continue to go along with you. And those periods hurt, dude. Those periods hurt bad. And so it's, you have to keep, you know, you have to keep moving forward. And one of the questions that I get along the way, that I've got in the past is, you know, John, what makes you different? You know, you grew up in this environment. A truth is, like, Nick, I should have been a father at 15 years old, and somehow by the grace of God, I wasn't, you know, and I have two kids now, so I know all the plumbing works, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, I should have, and I wasn't. And so I think about, I think about all the times that I could have screwed it up and got it wrong even myself. And the question that I get is, you know, what makes you different? And I think the thing that makes guys like us different, I think the thing that makes guys who don't become statistics in the correctional system different is we just keep moving heavyweight. We take the day as it comes. We don't let it push us down. Like, we might get knocked down. Like, you know, if you had a 120-pound, you know, rogue bag thrown at you, right? It would probably knock you down unless, right? It would knock me down, you know, but I would get back up with it, you know? And I think that's the thing that makes guys like us different is that we keep getting back up. So let me ask you this, Nick. How much stock do you have in the Enneagram, the personality profile? Do you think that thing's accurate, helpful, or do you think it's like, I don't know, like shamanic?
Yeah, I'm a 3-wing 4, so...
All right, so there you go. All right, so I listened to Ian Croyne's book, The Road Back to You, and it was Ryan Guerrera, and Ryan's another guy in the Dads community, and Ryan introduced me to this book because Ryan and I are both 8s, and we are both, you know, gung-ho, let's move this thing forward, 8s. And when I was listening to the Croyne's book, I discovered I was an 8, but two, I discovered something about 8s that was fascinating to me. And he said, you know, 8s, they don't really want to be the boss, but good luck trying to tell them what to do. And I thought, guilty, you know. And the other thing that he said about 8s is that it's not that 8s intentionally mean to be insubordinate or anything like that. It's not that 8s are out to be, you know, 8s are not to be free radicals in the world, just wreaking havoc wherever they go. That's not the thing about 8s. But it's that 8s have learned to, 8s have learned to fend for themselves. And 8s, typically 8s had their childhood robbed from them. And 8s had to grow up very young. And that's interesting because a part of that backstory is, dude, I was making, you know, mayonnaise sandwiches, 2 pieces of bread and mayonnaise when I was like 5 years old.
Right.
You know, I was washing my own clothes by the time I was 6 years old. You know, like the home that we grew up in, that I grew up in was it was rough. Like it was really, there was always a mess. Dishes were always piled in the sink. There were always like things crawling around the house, you know, big and small. And, you know, it's kind of like, and I really had to work through this. And for your audience, I want to give you guys something to really consider here. I came to 31, 32 years old, and I could tell you everything that I was against. I could tell you everything I didn't want to be when I grew up, right? I could tell you everything that I was just, well, I don't want to do this and I don't want to do that and I don't, right? And I had a friend of mine, he's a pastor in like Oklahoma or something. And this dude's like 6'8", like 400 pounds. This is huge, man. And on the phone, he says to me, he says, John, you know, I've known you for a while now and I tell you everything that you're against, but I don't know anything that you stand for. And when he said that, dude, that crippled me because I couldn't tell him anything that I stood for either, you know? And I went back to the book Boundaries, you know, Townsend and Cloud. I considered that, you know, one of the boundaries is you have to know what you stand for. You have to, what do you believe in? What are you proactively moving toward? It's not that we're just constantly running away from things. As a matter of fact, that's the worst reason to live most of the time is by being known by what you're against. I mean, all you have to do is turn on Facebook and, you know, read news and read the captions in news to see what people are against, right? I mean, anybody can point out the problem, but it takes something different to point out the solution, you know? And so I began to go to work on that. And, you know, it's interesting, man. It's interesting, Nick, because I think Life That Counts was born out of that discovery as I think about it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I know one thing you're against. One thing that you're for, sorry, flip it on you. Because we sifted through, you know, the things that you have out there for people to consume, and you can't be serious about making a difference in kids and being active in schools without being very concerned about what in the world is going on with kids that make that decision to come in and shoot the place up. So I know one thing that you're for is, how about a world where we don't have one more school shooting? And so I know that's a heavy topic, and there's your 120 pound bag I just threw at you. Tell me about that. Tell me your thoughts on those scenarios, those situations, and what you're doing and what we can do to make that, you know, be the reality, not one more.
Well, so I have some experience with this. I have never shared this in a recorded setting before, but I'll share it with you and your audience here, Nick. So when I was in sixth grade, well, actually it started a little before that. There was a guy in our school who had survived a house fire, and because he is in the house fire had left him with some physical differences, and he did not look like the rest of us. He did not talk like the rest of us. He didn't walk like the rest of us. He never wore short pants. He always wore long pants because of the way the house fire had left his legs and this kind of thing. And this is something that I've shared at schools before, when schools want to hear this message for their kids. Because there is a message of compassion in there, but I'll go beyond what I typically share at schools here, and I'll share the rest of it because I believe you have a largely adult audience. So in sixth grade, this guy was a friend of mine, and you know, going from elementary school to middle school. So elementary ended for us in fifth, and going to sixth grade, oh dude, it was different. I mean, we went from being the big dogs to the small shrimp, you know, on campus. And so we were all of a sudden in a kind of an urban environment, urban school setting, on campus with sixth, seventh, and eighth graders. And man, some of those eighth graders were like, you know, they were huge to us, at least. I mean, facial hair and muscles and, you know, lifting weights, play football and that kind of thing. And we were just tiny coming in. And there were a few of those eighth graders who gave my friend a hard time, to say the very least. I'm pretty sure others were aware of it. I won't get into that, but. And the man, they pushed this guy around. They kicked him around. There was one instance in the locker room where I was shooting basketball, and I thought I'd heard him scream, you know, or yell in the locker room. I went in, and there's three or four guys that's got this guy in the floor. He's in a fetal position in the floor just with his head covered, and they're kicking him and spitting at him and cussing him. And I actually grabbed his foot and pulled him out of the locker room, you know. And that's a rough day. Well, the last day of sixth grade year, we had field day at school. And, you know, field day is kind of a free-for-all, and it's probably the only day at school that you don't have to go to, but you actually want to because it's going to be fun.
Yeah.
Right? And school lets out at like 2:35, and it's like 2:15. And we're sitting at the top of the bleachers, and our gym had, you know, basketball goals around the sides and on both ends of the court. And we're almost kind of tucked away behind a basketball goal. And my friend pulls out a revolver, and he loads it or checks it to see if it's loaded. and he pulls back the hammer, and those three or four guys who had been giving him a hard time that year were actually shooting ball at the goal right in front of us. And he takes aim toward these guys. He begins to take aim, and he pulls back the hammer. And I just kind of began to – there was three of us sitting in the bleachers, and the guy to his left – I was sitting to his right. The guy to his left was just, you know, the full amygdala hijack had set in. I mean, fight, flight, freeze, he was frozen, right? And I just kind of began to, come on, man, you're better than this. Be the bigger man here. Look, you're not those guys. Look, you don't have to be like those guys. Come on, let's go outside and take a breath. Like, this ain't you. This isn't who you are, man. Come on. Come on. Let's do something different. And then I finally just kind of say, all right, man, let's go outside and take a breath. Like, put this thing away. Let's just go outside and take a breath for a minute. And we did. He began to lower the hammer. And I was freaking out when he's lowering the hammer because, you know, hands are sweaty, and I hope to God he wouldn't have let it slip and it went off accidentally at that point, right? And but he lowered the hammer, put it down, and we walked down the stairs, walked down the bleachers, and we turned to go out the door. And one of our football coaches is standing right there at the door, you know, one of those stoic guys with the mustache and the big glasses kind of a thing. You know, the guy that never smiles, never laughs. I mean, he has one look and it's like, you know, a statue, right?
Right.
And I tug on a shirt. I mean, it's one of those guys who his shirt is so tight down into his pants. Like, there's got to be something holding on a shirt from his shoes or something, right? And I tug on a shirt, pull on it till it almost comes untucked. And he follows us outside. And I look at my friend and I say, hey, man, you got something you need to tell Coach. And with tears in his eyes, my friend takes the pistol and puts it in the coach's hands. And Coach began to kind of tear up. And I've always wondered how much of that was his own personal guilt. Yeah. But he began to tear up. And he put his arm around my friend. And they walked into the school. And that was actually the last time I'd ever seen my friend.
Wow.
You know, I'd even gone by his house a few times that summer in between our sixth and seventh grade year to see if, you know, he was home or whatever. And they, like, his family had moved. I don't know. I don't know what happened to him. But, you know, I know so much of this is around, like, the gun debate and, you know, personal rights and different things like that. But, oh, man. I hear that, but can we just sit down that political football for a minute? Because it's this, our lives are not political capital, right? Our rights, I'll say this too, I get both sides. Our rights are not political capital. Our lives are not political capital. Can we acknowledge that there is a human element here? Right? And can we acknowledge that something in our system has really done a piss poor job of identifying needs, hurts, emotional wounds, scarring, like, we've yet to do, we talk about mental health all the time, and we've yet to do a really good job of trying to come up with a solution of what it even means to be mentally healthy. We don't even teach that, man. You know, like, some of these things, what does it matter? Dude, you're going to get me wound up here. What does it, like, honest to God, what does it matter if I can do advanced trigonomics or whatever, or what does it matter if I know how a cell divides? What do any of those things really, they really don't matter if I don't know how to process what's going on in my own mechanisms, right? I don't really know. Like, none of that stuff really matters. Sure. if I know how to add value and be service oriented and show compassion to people around me, right? We so in our culture, we so, dude, I'm 6'3", 245 pounds. I can bench press a house. I can squat the same. Like I look the part, I play the part, and it kind of irritates the mess out of me at times, right? Because I look like the poster boy for like American entrepreneurialism, like go get them, carry the football. Like I look like the poster boy for that, right? But what drives me mad is how in our culture, we place so much value on external appearances and we don't take time to get to see the person for the person, right? We don't take the time to understand, you know, a person's hurts and a person's wounds and a person's like how they can be cared for and how they can be loved. And I get what, to take the time, you know, who was it? It was Stephen Covey who in his 7 Habits of Highly Productive People. We don't really take the time to seek to understand and then be understood. And what's even worse is the people who teach the same concepts, they fail to do them themselves, you know? And it's kind of like, can we just acknowledge the power and influence of that we have over one another? Every human alive has power and influence. Everything that we come across. Dude, I was walking on the beach yesterday with my wife in Gulf Shores, Alabama, because we were like one of the first ones in the country to open up beaches. So I was one of the crazy ones who's like, I'm ready to go fill some sand. And there's this guy standing on the beach with a Pearl Jam t-shirt on. And I started humming Daughter in my head, you know? Mm-hmm. And like 10 minutes later, I'm still humming some Pearl Jam, you know? And I'm like, this dude's t-shirt was influential to my thoughts. Sure. He didn't even open up his mouth and say anything, mm-hmm. right? And we hold so much sway and so we hold so much power, you know, with our influence. And so I'm completely convinced, like there's no doubt anymore. There's zero doubt that peer influence is a capital that we can no longer afford to neglect and ignore.
Absolutely.
We cannot ignore the power of peer influence, and we do it all the time.
Sure. So let me tap into that a little bit. So, you know, I was brought up in the church. I'm a believer, and, you know, I have all my accolades in higher academia and all that. And my wife's an educator. I know that you know, are married to an educator. And so I've lived through some of those experiences as well, where my wife, you know, school's been put on lockdown and my wife's calling me on her cell phone, freaked out of her mind, and me jamming down the freeway. I actually left graduate school class one time and was flying down the freeway 85, 90 miles an hour to be there. What I was going to do when I got there, I don't know, but that is unfortunately some of the reality of, you know, what it means to raise kids in schools today. Right. So I've got a 16-year-old, I've got a 12-year-old, my wife no longer works directly in the school. She's moved on, done something different with her career. Reason why I'm telling this story is, you know, there's a movement within the church, and there's some denominations that actually hit this harder than other ones about, you know, your kids ought to be in Christian education and your kids ought to be going to Christian schools. And I, truth be told, I went to Christian schools from, you know, K through 12, except for 1 year. And one of my college experiences was at a faith-based university. So I get that. But we made a conscious decision to keep our kids in public school because we believe in salt and light. And that peer influence that you talked about, that's the reason why, right? Those boys are in there to be like you.
Yeah.
To be that buffer, that layer of resilience when it matters the most, right? The Bible talks about wisdom as being people who understand the times and know what to do. And I just couldn't sit by and keep my boys who we are building up and we are equipping and saying, you know, go over here with these like-minded people. No, you got to be in, you got to be on the fire. I'm sorry. And you've got to be saying no to what's wrong. You've got to be standing up to people who hurt people, right? We talked about that. And so, I have to believe that when people choose to be cruel to another human being, you know, that's them acting on their own insecurity, their own hurtness in their life. So I don't, you know, there's context for that as well. Call me foolish, call me silly, but that's the reason why we've kept our boys in the public school system. Mom and dad will handle the education piece, to be quite honest, in terms of what they may or may be missing. Right. But,
I feel that.
That's the reason. And we had a close call. So we had a kid in I'm in the youth correctional system, right? So I see them, and I've seen some of the most infamous, you know, nationwide school shooter there is. And, you know, we'll leave his name out of it because we don't want to give necessary glory to those types of aspects. So I've seen it and I've worked directly with it. I've shared the same airspace with it. But we had a scenario when my oldest son was in middle school, right? Middle school seems to be the you know, the pressure cooker for this, right? And long story short, we got a message from the school saying we had a scenario where a kid has threatened to shoot kids at the middle school. Parents, it's okay. He's been apprehended, yada, yada, yada. It's okay to send your kid to school tomorrow, but if you don't, we understand. So when my son got home, I grilled him. I said, do you know who that kid was? And he's like, yeah. And then he said, because I've in tune with my son and who he hangs out with and through sports and whatnot, we know the characters. And I said, we knew that there was a list. So the kid had a list. So he had posted it on social media. Mm-hmm. And I said, was your name on the list to my son? He's like, no. I rattle off some other names. I said, was this kid's name on the list? He said, yeah. Was this kid's name on the list? He said, yeah. And I was pretty accurate, right? And I told him, I said, that's the lesson. It never pays to be a bully, right? And he said, Dad, I wasn't a bully. I actually, you know, we were in the same magic card club together. I said, good, right? Because you need to be extending yourself. You need to be reaching out. And you need to say enough's enough when people get that way. So there's me getting vulnerable. That was you getting vulnerable. So I appreciate this opportunity to exchange stories there on a huge, important topic, right? And the political football aside, absolutely, right? We may never settle that argument in this country, right? But what we can do is exactly what you're doing, right? We can make a difference from a peer-to-peer level, on a father-to-son level, onto a neighbor-kid level to, you know, I coach sports not because I really care about sports, because I know the impact that a positive person can have in another person's life. The Pearl Jam t-shirt for you on the beach last night, you know, the words that I remember from my sporting times that what my coaches said, they're still seared in my being. Like I can call them up more than cell dividing in biology class. Right. And so I want to be able to do that for the kids that I've have contact with through coaching. Yes. It's about sports. Yes. I like to win. Yes. I like to be competitive, but I know that there's kids that are on my teams that if somebody doesn't see them for who they are and then invest in them, they could be end up, you know, being that person who does something heinous in school. So that's my way of being out there and making an impact, making a difference one-to-one level.
There is a ton there. And it's even to your point on coaching. And as parents all the way around, we should never put ourselves in a position where we're sacrificing or compromising our personal integrity, our personal power, our personal compassion and kindness for a win or for some sort of trophy or some sort of accolade. I know we're getting to a place where we need to wrap this up. I know you've got another engagement and I've actually got two calls scheduled on top of the other, but there's a, when my oldest son was born, when Jaden was born, I was a 22, 23 year old father who had never experienced having had a father himself. And I remember when he was laying in our room that very first night, and my wife was, his rolling cart was over by her bed, and I just looked at him and I pulled out my Bible. I'd never read, what is it, Psalm 127, I think. I think it's Psalm 127. I may be wrong on the address, but it says, unless the Lord builds the house, those who labor in vain. And then it goes on to talk about how children are like arrows in your quiver. And I really didn't get that then. I was like, okay, arrows, kids, I'm going to shoot them. Like, all right, that's, what is that about? You know? But to your point, you know what, man, it's very true. We're not called, right? If you're a person of faith and if you're a believer, you're not called to be a separatist. Now, you're called to be holy, and the idea of holy is to be set apart. Yes. But there's a difference between being set apart and being a separatist. And we're not called to isolate and to, you know, find a cabin in the woods and sip the Kool-Aid for the rest of our life. Like, that's not what it's about. Mm-hmm. We're called to mix it up in our culture. We're called to be, you know, for some people, for those who are unbelievers, I heard a pastor put it this way. And it was Driscoll out of when he was still in Seattle, mm-hmm. before he moved to Arizona. And I heard Mark put it this way. He said, you know, for unbelievers, this lifetime is the best that it's ever going to get. But for the believer, this lifetime is going to be the worst that it's ever going to get. And the difference always between the believer and the unbeliever is the believer is to be a person who has hope. And the thing that sets us apart is that we put hope on display. We put forgiveness on display. We put love on display. We put kindness and compassion on display. We practice self-abnegation. It's not that we can't have things, right? It's not that we're living lives of poverty or anything like that. Like, that's ridiculous, right? That's not what it's about, right? Your father being, you know, how many of you, if your son asks you for, you know, something to eat, you give him a stone or you give him a steak. He says, no, you give him what he wants. And he says, so how much more so your heavenly father, right? He sees what you need and he'll give you and whatever, like, go for it. You have not because you ask not. And that's, it's not a prosperity thing even at that, because you still have to work and put in the reps and that kind of thing. But the big idea is that, man, we're called to be vessels of hope, and we're called to be vessels of love, and we're called to be vessels of kindness and compassion. And this is where sometimes I think our faith communities miss it. Because sometimes I think our faith communities miss it when we don't do a good enough job of teaching people how to live on purpose in a way that is attractional. Because if you live a set apart life, if you live a called life, you know, Paul says in the New Testament, this one thing I do, I press on toward the upward call, right? If you live that life where you're constantly pressing on and you're not just beating as one who beats against the air, right? But you're actually beating for something on purpose, and you're actually looking to add value, and you're actually looking to like create, like, you know what? I spent time on planet Earth, and planet Earth is going to remember me in this way. How can you not live in a way that is attractional? How can you not live in a way that others around you are like, this guy, man, that Nick, he's different. Like, his wife actually likes him. Like, his kids actually want to spend time with him. Like, man, I wished I had that, right? And that's, to me, that's what it's about. Like, look at Nick on the interstate. He doesn't get all hyperventilated headspace when somebody cuts him off in traffic. He just takes time to calm down. And, you know, he may even tap the brakes like Jason Palmer would tell us to do and figure out how to be the calm in the room, right? And, man, I just think about that, and I'm like, that's what it's about, dude. That's what it's about. It's about, you know, I don't want to do a play on words here, but it really is, to me, about living a life that counts. And to me, a life that counts is a life that's like, I want to live so on purpose. Because, dude, I shouldn't be here. Like, I should be a statistic. I should either be dead or incarcerated. Like, I should not be where I'm at.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And if guys like me can get here just by continuing to pick up that 120-pound bag and trying to move one foot in front of the other, then I really think anybody can get there. Mm-hmm. With the right amount of love, with the right amount of encouragement, with the right amount of outside support. Anyway, I don't want to go on. I know we need to put the landing gear down here.
I appreciate it. You know, my golden thread when I was thinking about what to call what I'm doing and looking at all the different things that I was active with, my golden thread was I was tired of seeing people who, number one, didn't realize and didn't reach their potential. Mm. And especially with kids that come into youth corrections, that was where it was front and center. And then I started looking at all the things that I was doing, and yeah, that's what I do. Whether I'm teaching or coaching or training or educating, inspiring, I want people to, number one, realize who they are and what they were meant to do, right? You were put here for a reason. Realize that. And then now that you realize that, you've got to get to work. You've got to reach that potential. And for me, it's an always, you know, ever increasing meter of potential, but that's just me personally. But that part that you were talking about, you know, living life on purpose. Living life on purpose. So that's my golden thread, helping people realize and reach their potential. So John, you know, this was, you know, honestly kind of turned into two dads exchanging stories about, you know, what happens in the process of growing up and becoming fathers and kind of what our role is here. And that's perfect. And my hope, you know, I'm convicted that there's somebody that is going to listen to this and they're going to hear this message, but they're going to kind of be like you were, right? Meaning, okay, I hear it, but I don't believe it. Like, I, you know, that might be good for John. That might be good for Nick. That might be good for the guy that lives down the street. But I don't believe it. What would you say to that person who has heard what you have said, has heard what I had to say, and they've got that spark inside, but they don't believe it, or they don't know what to do with it? What would you say to them?
I would say that you really are enough. I would say that I get it. I know how you feel. I know how it feels to be insignificant. I know how it feels to feel like you're inadequate. I know how it feels to feel like you're worthless. I know how it feels to feel like you're a dreamer. I know how it feels to feel like you may even be at a place, man, where you're ready to consider ending your own life because you're like, you know, what's the point of this? You know, what is this life for? Like, was the purpose of this entire experience just pain? I don't want that. I'm tired of pain. You know, I'm tired of not having hope. And what I want to say to you, wherever you're at, is I want to say that you really are enough. I want to say that there's something there really is, that dream that you have inside of you, man. If you can just hang on to it long enough, you can experience it. You may not have all the skills that it's going to take for you to reach your dream in the next, you know, 2 or 3 or 5 or 7 or 9 years. But what's it say, Nick? It says hope deferred makes the heart sick, but when dreams come true, it's like a wellspring of life. And man, that dream was put inside of you. You know, for me, my dream was my wife's going to know her husband and my kids are going to know their father. And that's the platform that I truly want to stand on. And that even our message to students when we go into schools and stuff like that, that's what I share with kids. my wife was going to know, her husband and my kids are going to know that was my dream. And I got to have my dream, and I'm getting to live my dream, right? And you can, whoever you are, you can too, if you'll just hang on to it long enough. And if you'll just believe, if you can believe in yourself, if you can believe in who you are, and if you can believe in who you're created to be and not just write it off. I know others may have written you off. Right? Your peers at school, man, maybe even your own family. Maybe you're like me and you're missing out on one of your biological parents, or maybe even both of your biological parents your entire life. You never met either one of them. And maybe you feel completely thrown away. Maybe you're in some sort of system, foster or adopted or something like that, and your birth certificate's incomplete. It doesn't have either one of your parents' names on it. And maybe you feel just completely worthless. I just want to say to you, you're not. Because what Marianne Williamson says when she says that we were made to create it, when we were created to shine, that not only applies to me, man, but that applies to you too. You were created to shine. You were created to have a beautiful experience. You were created to, just like I got to do yesterday, walking on the beach with my wife and with my kids and throwing the baseball with my kids on the beach and just getting the hangout and stuff like that and enjoying good food and that kind of thing. Like that's what I like to do. And you were created, like you were given that dream for you so that you can experience that hope, right? You can experience that when that dream comes true, it's a wellspring of life, and it can be a wellspring of life for you. So right now, wherever you are, man or woman, young man or young woman listening to this, what I want to encourage you to do is I want to encourage you to find something to practice gratitude for. I want to encourage you to find something that you can do today to begin to march toward that version of you that you see for you. I want to encourage you to begin to gravitate toward people, toward mentors, toward coaches, toward influences who help build a strong and resilient mindset for you, because it's going to take it. Again, back to what coaches said to us. I had a coach who said to me, he said, if it were easy, everyone would be doing it. And one of the mindsets as an eight on the Enneagram that I kind of developed early on was that, you know what, if it's worth doing, it's worth doing wrong, because eventually you're going to get it right. If you'll just keep after it, eventually you're going to get it right. And man, I just want to encourage you with that, wherever you are in your life, wherever you are in your walk. And if there is anything to do, if there's anything that I know, speaking for both Nick or myself, if there's anything that either one of us could do, like, please allow us the opportunity to become someone in your corner so that we can help encourage you along.
Wow. Mic drop. That's what they call that, folks. Mic drop. And I'm glad that you put me up to that, because I was going to do the same to you, right? So if there's people that are listening to this, we're two guys that are willing to make time for most anybody, reach out, and you are enough. You heard a lot about John's background and how he had to become personally convicted that he is enough, despite how he was brought into this world. I've got a similar story that if you sift back through some of my other episodes, you can hear some of that. But I so appreciate you, John, for coming on, sharing about who you are and life that counts, and just, you know, your desire to move from success to significance. Right. And yeah, we can all have personal success. That's great. But what are you going to do? What's the mark that you're going to leave on this world? Right. And I just so much appreciate you coming on here.
Oh man, it's 100% my pleasure. And I can't wait to return the favor so that we can continue this conversation.
Absolutely.
All right, brother.
All right. Thank you.
My pleasure.
That was John Williams. And I have to apologize. If you're listening to this episode, and if you're anything like I was when I had to press stop on the record and I had to move on for my day just like he did, I was disappointed. I was disappointed because there is so much more that John and I could have talked about. We could have gone even deeper into the topics that we did cover. And here's my promise, we will do it again. And we will do it again, and we will do it again. I see myself and John connecting in that way and making sure that our messages, his passion for what he is doing with Life That Counts, my passion for what I'm doing with The Upgraded Life, our background and histories are very similar. We have a lot of commonalities in terms of the things that we saw growing up, the things that were imprinted on our souls, and we are leveraging those experiences to make a difference in this world. So we will do it again. If you felt like that conversation was cut short, you're right, it was. But there'll be chapter 2, chapter 3, chapter 4. All right. I just want to appreciate John Williams for making time for me during this COVID-19 scenario. He had just opened up his shop that day. It was the first day that his staff was back all together, all in one place. So there was a lot going on for him. So again, much appreciation to him and his team and for making time for me and this podcast. The things that he talked about, the things that he has going, he's a keynote speaker. You can hire him for your events, especially if they're youth-oriented and focused. I'm sure he would love to be able to take that opportunity up with you. All the things that he has going, I will put links to in my show notes. My website is www.nicksotelo.com/TUL podcast, The Upgraded Life Podcast. While you're over at my website, don't forget to check out the three opportunity buttons at the very top. They are scheduling a time with me. I'll give you a free 30-minute strategy session. Checking out CBD products from Nature's Ultra. And then also, if you're looking to create an additional stream of income, I can help you out with that too. This takes 20 minutes of your time. Click on the button that says Income Boost. Give me your name and email, and I'll send you a presentation. Thank you again so much for listening to my show, The Upgraded Life Podcast. If you got something out of Keith Weber's information, his info on kettlebells and mindset and just his overall story, let me know by going over to Apple Podcasts, leave me a 5-star review, and that will tell me that you enjoyed the show. This is Dr. Nick Sotelo, and I'm urging you to do something today to realize and reach your potential, and I'll catch you on the next show.